think we need to get started to keep on time, and I wanted to welcome everybody to the 2010 Recent Advances Lecture. I'm Frank Gilliam, the program chair of this year's meeting. It is a great honor and privilege to be able to introduce our plenary speaker this afternoon, Dr. John P. Holdren, Assistant to the President for Science and Technology and Director of the Office of Science and Technology in the Executive Office of the President of the United States. Dr. Holdren had asked me to keep the introduction down, and it's going to be briefer than it was written, but it's still quite lengthy because his past is stellar and quite impressive. So as a little bit of background, first of all, he was born just around here, close to Pittsburgh, and at the age of four then moved, I guess, to California, where he grew up in San Mateo, attending public schools from elementary to high school. His degrees are in aerospace engineering and theoretical plasma physics from MIT and Stanford, and has authored well over 300 publications on global environmental change, energy technology and policy, nuclear arms control and nonproliferation, and science, technology, and policy. He's a member of several academies, including the National Academies of Science and of Engineering, the American Academy of Arts and Science, and the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as a foreign member of the Royal Society of London. He's a former president of the AAAS, former chair of the Federation American Scientists, and one of the first recipients in 1981 of the MacArthur Foundation Prize Fellowship. From 1994 to 2001, he served as President Clinton's counsel, a member of the Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. In the similar time period, he chaired the Committee on International Security and Arms Directors of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Prior to joining the Obama administration, he was the Teresa and John Hines Professor of Environmental Policy and Director of the Program on Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government and Professor of Environmental Sciences and Policy in the Department of Earth, Plant, and Planetary Science at Harvard. Concurrently, from 2005, he served as Director of the Woods Hole Research Center, and from 2002, co-chair of the Independent Bipartisan National Commission on Energy Policy. He's been married for 43 years to another Dr. Holdren, Dr. Cheryl E. Holdren. They have two grown children and five grandchildren, ages 3 to 18. And without any further ado, join me in welcoming Dr. John P. Holdren as he gives his address, Sustainability, the Obama Administration, and the Mob.
Well, thank you very much, Frank, and thank all of you for coming. Those sitting in the back will have some trouble with a bit of the fine print, but we'll make this PowerPoint available for anybody who wants to catch up with the details. I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground, as the title suggests, starting with what I call the conceptual underpinnings, the relationship between ingredients of human well-being and the question of sustainability, what some of the key challenges in sustainability are, some of the metrics for how we're doing with respect to aiming for and approaching sustainability. Emphasis then on two particular challenges that are not really well captured in the Millennium Development Goals, which are often used as the main metric for thinking about our progress. The two challenges that I'll be elaborating on are what I call the energy economy environment dilemma, and above all its climate change component, and secondly, the competition among different human uses for land, water, and biomass, or said another way familiar to this audience, competition for the net primary productivity of the planet. And I'll talk a little bit about the progress we've been able to make in the Obama administration on some of these issues, and finally say a few words about the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, MOB. So to start with the foundations, I like to talk about human well-being as being supported on a three-legged stool, supported by three pillars: economic conditions and processes, socio-political conditions and processes, environmental conditions and processes. And you can make your own elaborations. I've made a list of some of the ingredients there. Anybody here could make, no doubt, a longer list. But the key point is that in the past, when people talked about development, they talked mainly about strengthening the economic pillar. Recently, the socio-political and the environmental pillars have started to get somewhat more attention, but they remain, I think, widely undervalued compared to the economic pillar. People still too often talk about development as equivalent to economic growth. And the fact is, the reality is, that the three pillars are co-equal in importance because each one is indispensable and they are all interconnected. If you pull out any leg of a three-legged stool, the stool falls down. The interconnections, again, will be fairly obvious to people in this group. The economy needs environmental inputs and it needs socio-political stability. Many socio-political and environmental improvements we might want to make have to be paid for, hence depend on a degree of economic well-being. We know that socio-political stability and values cannot survive either economic or environmental disaster. If you had any doubt about socio-political stability and environmental disaster, you have only to think back recently to the Haiti earthquake or the Katrina hurricane hitting New Orleans, where socio-political stability collapsed rather quickly and would not have been restored except for large external inputs. Now, with that background, I think it should be obvious that development really needs to mean improving human well-being in all three dimensions, economic, socio-political, and environmental. And sustainable development ought to mean doing that by means and endpoints that are consistent with maintaining the improvements indefinitely. If we think about it, we should realize that getting to sustainability entails not only employing sustainable development to achieve well-being where it's now absent, but it also entails putting the maintenance and expansion of well-being where it's now present onto a sustainable basis. And the fact is, we are far from doing either one, and we are moving much too slowly on both. Key challenges in the sustainability domain are easy, I think, to enumerate: eradicating extreme poverty, defeating preventable and epidemic diseases, mastering the energy economy environment dilemma, above all, providing the energy our economies need without wrecking the climate that our environment needs, adapting to the degree of climate change that can no longer be avoided, and managing at the same time the intensifying competition for the planet's land, water, and biomass. These are the really tough ones. Now, those challenges, again, are interconnected. Poverty and local environmental degradation are linked in a vicious circle of cause and effect. Deforestation for fuel woods, subsistence farming, desertification and erosion from overgrazing, all contributing to land use change of a destructive kind. Preventable disease is linked to both environment and poverty. Again, I think everybody in this room knows this: lack of sanitation and clean water, acute air pollution in rural dwellings from traditional fuels, the biggest air pollution problem in the world in terms of the number of people exposed and the concentrations and the durations of their exposure, malnutrition and low birth rate from inadequate diets all link environment and poverty to disease. And economic progress, of course, and this is a major part of the dilemma, intensifies the competition among different human uses for land, water, and net primary productivity, as well as intensifying the energy economy climate dilemma. We know that improved diets that come with increasing incomes increase the demand for grain, for animal feed, for grazing land, for soybeans, for fish. The use of water and energy rise rapidly with income. And climate change, which comes largely from energy supply, is imperiling both terrestrial and marine food production and water availability, and it's increasing the demand for biofuels to replace fossil fuels, and it's increasing the demand for standing forests to keep carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So how are we doing? Well, you're probably all familiar with the Millennium Development Goals and targets. There are a lot of goals. Under each goal, there are multiple targets. Some of them are related to the big challenges I've mentioned here. Number 7 is ensure environmental sustainability. Talks about a few measures of that, but not many, in fact. Number 8, a global partnership for development, still largely missing. And if you look at how we're doing on some of these goals on hunger, we are not remotely on track to meet the Millennium Development Goals on hunger. The yellow lines are the target, And then the other lines show where we were in 90, 92, 2000, 2002, 2005, and 2007. We're not getting there fast enough. Child mortality, the same. Some progress, but we're not getting there nearly fast enough. And if you look at sustainability, the indices they do have, and they don't really have good indices related to either of the big challenges I'm talking about, either climate change or the competition for environmental resources, but sanitation practices. Half the population of developing regions remains without sanitation. The 2015 target is almost certainly impossible to reach. They do have a biodiversity index looking at the number of species facing extinction according to the IUCN Red List. And these numbers show the percentages expected to survive over the relatively short term, and they're mostly going down. That is, we're doing worse on biodiversity and extinctions. Now, let me turn to what I regard as the two toughest challenges, starting with the energy, economy, environment dilemma. The essence of this dilemma is, first of all, that available and affordable energy is indispensable for meeting basic human needs, for increasing standards of living, and for fueling economic growth. But at the same time, harvesting, transporting, and using energy are responsible for, indeed, are the primary cause of many of the most damaging and intractable environmental threats to human well-being at every scale, from the local to the regional to the global. Energy is responsible for most indoor and outdoor air pollution. It's responsible for much of the hydrocarbon and trace metal contamination of soil and groundwater. It's responsible for essentially all of the oil added by humans to the seas. There are natural seeps, but they're far smaller than what we do. And, of course, the most compelling current example of that has been ongoing in the Gulf of Mexico for more than 3 months now. Energy is responsible for the production of most radioactive waste and, of course, for most of society's emissions of the greenhouse gases that are disrupting global climate. Of all of those impacts, climate change is, I think, without question, both the most dangerous and the most intractable. It's the most dangerous because climate is the envelope within which all other environmental conditions and processes have to operate. And if you distort that envelope enough, as we are well on our way to doing, everything within that envelope, all the other environmental conditions and processes, are at risk. It's the most intractable because the main driver of the problem is the emission of carbon dioxide from fossil fuel use, and fossil fuel use is supplying 80% of all of the energy used in the world today. Even when you count the traditional fuels, the fuel wood, charcoal, crop waste, and dung that are usually left out of official accountings. If you leave those out, the fraction of fossil fuels is even larger. And this is an extremely difficult problem to deal with, not just because the fossil fuel percentage of world energy supply is so large, but because the volume of CO2 produced by burning the coal and oil and natural gas is enormous. Burning 1 kilogram of coal makes 3 kilograms of carbon dioxide. Even though the coal is dark and hard and solid and the carbon dioxide is invisible and dilute, it's an immense quantity, therefore very expensive and difficult to capture and sequester away from the environment. And changing the energy system very quickly is simply impossible. The energy system represents an investment of roughly $15 trillion. That's what it would cost to replace all the power plants, pipelines, drilling rigs in the world today, $15 trillion. And ordinarily, that $15 trillion investment turns over in about 40 years. That's the average lifetime of an energy facility. What that means, if you want the energy system in 2050 to look very different than the energy system looks today, you have to start changing it now. Now, let me talk a little more about the climate dimension of this challenge in terms of 5 myths. Number one, a little global warming won't hurt anything. Number two, the Earth has been cooling since 1998. Number three, if climate change is a problem, it's only a problem for our descendants far in the future. Number four, the hacked emails from East Anglia University and the mistakes discovered in the IPCC's latest report show that mainstream science is deeply flawed, if not fraudulent. And number five, taking serious action to reduce climate change risks will wreck the economy. All of these are nonsense, but it's important to understand why. Let me start with a proposition that the term global warming itself was a mistake by our whole community. Global warming is a dangerous misnomer. It implies something that's uniform across the planet, that's mainly about temperature, that's gradual, and that's quite possibly benign. What could be wrong with a little bit of warming? What's actually happening is highly non-uniform geographically and in time. It's not just about temperature, but as I will explain further in a moment, about many, many other facets of weather and climate. It is rapid compared to the capacities of both ecosystems and social systems to adjust, and it is harmful for most places and times. A few places for a little while may get some benefits, but overwhelmingly, climate change is already having negative impacts, and that imbalance, negative versus positive, will only get larger over time. We really should be calling this global climate disruption. It's a bit more of a mouthful, but at least it's not misleading in the way global warming is. The reasons average temperature isn't the whole story reside in the proposition that climate consists of the patterns of weather, the averages, the extremes, the timing, the spatial distribution of everything about the weather, hot and cold, cloudy and clear, humid and dry, how hard it rains, how much it snows, when it melts, how hard the wind blows, all the way up from breezes to typhoons. And climate change means disruption of the patterns. The global average surface temperature is just an index of the state of the global climate as expressed in those patterns, just as your body temperature is an index of the state of your body. Your body temperature goes up a couple degrees C, you know you got a problem. The planetary temperature goes up a couple degrees C, we ought to know we have a problem. Small changes in that index correspond to big changes in the patterns and all that depends on them, and a lot depends on them. Climate governs, so climate disruption affects a whole lot of important things: availability of water, the productivity of our managed as well as unmanaged ecosystems, how much oppressive heat and humidity we have to deal with, air pollution directly linked to climate, the geography of disease, what pathogens, what vectors can live in what abundance at what times of the year in what places, fix the damages we have to expect from storms, floods, droughts, and wildfires, the property losses we have to expect from sea level rise, how much we have to spend on engineered environments, air conditioning, dikes, dams, and so on, and indeed the distribution and abundance of species of all kinds, those we love, like polar bears, those we hate, like, let's say, mosquitoes. Is it really true that the world has been cooling since 1998? Absolutely not. This is a scam which anyone familiar with statistics would detect in an instant. 1998 was a relatively hot year due to the confluence of a long-term warming trend and a very powerful El Nino. But if you look at the trends by decades or by multiple decades, the recent decade trend is virtually identical to the previous trend. It is trending up. The world is unquestionably heating up. Is harm only far in the future? Far from it. Think about floods and droughts, of which we have many more current examples this summer, but this is a particularly interesting one. This is a map of China and changes in precipitation, the trends in precipitation, millimeters per decade. What's going on here is that the East Asia monsoon has been weakening for 30 years in a pattern which Chinese climate models attribute to global climate change. I saw these results first in China. In fact, I saw them first in the office of the deputy head of the National Development and Reform Commission, which is the most powerful planning body in China. These results are known at the top of the Chinese establishment. And what has happened is that weakening of the monsoon has meant less moisture flow in the atmosphere over China from south to north, leading to increased flooding in the south, increased drought in the north, already serious impacts on property and on agriculture in China. This is one of the reasons that China is, in fact, serious about doing something about climate change. Wildfires. Wildfires in the western United States have increased about sixfold in the last 30 years. Similar trends evident in other fire-prone regions. Russia experiencing one of the hottest summers in their recorded history, probably the hottest one, suffering enormously from wildfires as well. And if you look at the recent National Academy's report on stabilization targets, which Susan Solomon led, you will see a most astonishing graphic, which I almost put in here, about the future of wildfires in the West, showing by what percentage the area burned annually in Western wildfires is expected to increase per degree C of global warming. And the numbers are mostly in the 200 to 400% category, 200 to 400% increases in average area burned per degree C in global warming. Again, the Moscow heat waves, absolutely extraordinary. In fact, harm is already occurring very widely. Worldwide, we're seeing increases in floods, wildfires, droughts, heat waves, pest outbreaks, coral bleaching events, the power of typhoons and hurricanes and the geographic range of tropical pathogens. And all of these are plausibly linked to climate change by theory, by models, and by the observed fingerprints, the timing and the geographic pattern in which these phenomena are materializing. Did so-called ClimateGate cast doubt on these conclusions? I don't think so. The emails showed, of course, that climate scientists are human too. They suffer frustration and irritation. They tend to resist sharing data with those they believe have no interest in truth-seeking. The missteps of the IPCC do show the need for following the IPCC's very rigorous review procedures carefully, but the errors discovered so far are very small in number and have no bearing whatsoever on the overall conclusions about what is happening in climate. It's also important to understand that IPCC is not the source of our understanding of climate change. It's just one of the messengers. The sources are the global community of climate scientists and the mountain of peer-reviewed research that they have produced over decades, of which the IPCC is simply our most distinguished and comprehensive interpreter and synthesizer. If you look at this whole climate case business, and recently a number of independent reviews have done so, they basically found it's a nothing burger. There is no impact at all on our understanding of what's going on in climate, and I can assure you that President Obama understands that with crystal clarity. Last myth, the proposition that we can't afford to reduce climate change risks. We really have only three options going forward in the climate change domain. One is mitigation, steps we take to reduce the pace and the magnitude of climate change. Second is adaptation, steps we take to reduce the harm from the changes in climate that cannot be avoided. And the third option is suffering. We're already doing some of all three. We're doing some mitigation, we're doing some adaptation, we're doing some suffering, as I've already mentioned. We'll do more of all three. What's up for grabs, though, is the mix. How much mitigation, how much adaptation, how much suffering. And if we want to minimize the suffering, we need to understand that we have got to get enough mitigation to avoid unmanageable climate change and enough adaptation to manage what we don't avoid. This was the subtitle of a study for the UN that Rosina Bierbaum, who's sitting down there in the front row, was one of the co-leaders of, and I was involved in. And the subtitle was Avoiding the Unmanageable and Managing the Unavoidable. It was a study of climate change and sustainable development. That subtitle was due to John Schellenhuber, one of our German participants. The cost of failing at this, the cost of failing to generate enough mitigation to avoid the unmanageable and enough adaptation to manage the unavoidable are going to be far, far higher than the costs of the mitigation and adaptation needed to succeed. If you look at the numbers, you can do it on the back of a very small envelope to get a rough estimate. Current global carbon dioxide emission rates from fossil fuels and deforestation combined amount to about 10 billion tons of contained carbon per year. If we were willing to pay $100 per ton of carbon to avoid half of that, that would be $500 billion a year. It's a lot of money, but it's under 1% of gross world product, and much of it is a transfer, not money going down a black hole. The world, by the way, spends 2.5% of gross world product on defense. The United States spends 5% of our own GDP on defense. We spend 2% on environmental protection. The idea that the world couldn't afford to spend 0.5% to avoid catastrophic climate change is ridiculous on its face. The mainstream models of energy, economy, climate, which struggle with this problem, have concluded that mitigation to stabilize the atmosphere at 450 to 550 parts per million of CO2 equivalent, and we really should be aiming for 450 if the truth be known, could amount to a 1 to 3% of the loss of gross world product in 2030 and in 2100. That's the range of the best estimates. Now, if you think about that, again, it's real money. But if you accept the economist's proposition that the economy of the world will still be growing at 2 or 3% real per year in those years, then what this means is to avoid a high likelihood of unmanageable climate change, people in 2050 would need to wait till September to be as rich as they otherwise would have been in January. This is not a big deal. Let me turn to the second of the toughest challenges, the competition for land and water and biomass. What do we need this stuff for? Well, we need land, of course, itself for a whole variety of purposes, water for a similar variety of purposes, land, water, and biomass together for food, forage, fiber, biofuels, chemical feedstocks, And we need land, water, and biomass for recreation, beauty, unspoiled nature, and ecosystem functions. Those ecosystem functions, again, I hardly need to recite for the people in this room, so I won't. This is my list. Most of you, I think, could probably, again, produce a longer list. We remain immensely dependent on nature for these crucial functions. Any notion that technology has displaced these is naive. We couldn't afford to displace most of these with technology, even if we knew exactly how to do it, which in most cases we do not. You look quantitatively at the competition for land and vegetation. The top map shows natural vegetation before humans started to fiddle very much with it. The middle shows the intensity of land use for croplands, and the bottom, the intensity of land use for pasture and rangeland. What you find is that croplands and pasture lands now cover about 40% of the world's land area. We've lost 10 million square kilometers, about 20% of the original forested area in the last 300 years, most of it in the last 50. Desert and near desert has increased by nearly as much. Cities, roads, and airports now covering 2% of the world's land. Not the biggest land user, but often covering some pretty precious kinds of lands, including on coastlines, wetlands, and so on. Look at the recent numbers for the annual net change in forest area. We're still losing ground in most parts of the world and quite rapidly. This is one that is, in a sense, more graphic, I think, than any bar chart. This is a picture taken from the air in Mato Grosso in Brazil. I call it competition for land on the ground, rainforest in Brazil versus tofu in China, the tofu fields closing in on this remaining strip of rainforest. And of course, then, as you think about these competitions and you think about biofuels, which are many people's choice as the savior in terms of how we're going to reduce our dependence on oil, and you ask yourself, where are those biofuels going to come from and the quantities needed really to have an impact? And this may be a promise, but it's also a threat when you look at the magnitudes that would be involved. Turn to the competition for water. This is the baseline. One thinks at first there's a lot of water in the world, 1.4 billion cubic kilometers. The amount that falls on land is 120,000 cubic kilometers a year. The total runoff and recharge is about 50,000, but when you get down to look at what's actually available for humans to use, subtracting uncaptured storm runoff and what falls in areas too remote to use it, we're down to 12,000 cubic kilometers a year, and humans are already using more than 40% of that. We're already using more than 40% of the available water flow. World desalting capacity, which some people think of as the answer, is tiny compared to what we're using. If you break down the use of 5,000 cubic kilometers a year, agriculture is the largest part of it, then comes industry, then comes domestic. Drinking water is not the issue, at least for most places in the world, but these much larger uses are. And you see enormous differences in the uses of water per person around the world, from Nigeria at 50 to the United States at 2,000, global average 800. You see it doesn't take much from where the global average is now to where, say, the United States is to use up all of the available flow, and that's without allowing for population increase. The geography of water stress currently, the black numbers are places in which major basins are already overexploited. That is, water is being used faster than precipitation runoff and recharge can replace it. The gray areas are marginal. That's going to get worse as well. Let me quickly run through a few obstacles to managing these two toughest of the sustainability challenges, climate change and the resource competition issues. One obstacle, of course, is the continuing pressure of rising population and affluence. A second is the impacts of global climate disruption, I've already mentioned, on water supply, plant productivity, and the demands for both biofuels and carbon sequestration. A third is toxic spillovers from agriculture, industry, and energy supply into ecosystems, both terrestrial and marine. Another is the multiple stress issue, lots of interacting stresses at play here. And finally, our consistent failure to charge a price for the consumption or destruction of environmental resources and services. Let's look at a few of these. Rising population and affluence, the IPAT relation, which Paul Ehrlich, who's also here in the second row, and I wrote down initially in 1970. Environmental impact, very simple algebraic relation. It equals the number of people times the income per person times the impact per unit of income. That's an identity. It might be misleading, but it can't be wrong. And in fact, Paul and I continue to think it's not even misleading. It's telling us quite a lot of important things. The technology factor clearly is the result of choices society makes about how the income is derived and spent. That means energy sources, manufacturing technologies, transportation systems, land use management. And obviously, the larger the product of population times affluence, the greater is the requirement for good choices about technology in order to limit environmental impact. This is from a paper published by Crutzen and Stefan in Climatic Change in 2003. It's a nice graphic depiction of what population and affluence have been doing for the last 250 years. Population top left, world real GDP next to it. Looking at the middle, damming of rivers on the left, water use in the middle, fertilizer consumption on the right, urban population going to the bottom, urban population, paper consumption, and McDonald's restaurants on the far right on the bottom. Another obstacle, toxic spillovers. This is, I think, absolutely stunning figure from Galloway and Company in 2004, showing the actual wet and dry reactive nitrogen deposition from the atmosphere in the early 1990s around the world and what's projected for 2050. Stunning amounts of reactive nitrogen deposition with huge potential ecological impacts. The interaction between climate change and water is extremely challenging. And again, I'm not going to read this very busy slide to you, but you get the idea just skimming it. There are a tremendous number of ways in which climate change is messing with the quantity and quality of the water we have available to us, even as these demands for clean water, which I've already talked about, are rising. Multiple stresses. This is a wonderful picture. Pine bark beetles, which courtesy of global climate change have had a longer breeding season, able to get four generations into a season rather than three, have been devastating trees weakened by heat and drought in Colorado. A similar phenomenon has occurred with the spruce budworm in Alaska. Millions of hectares of land devastated. Clearly an example of the kinds of multiple stress problem that we're almost certainly going to see more of. Let me turn then to the sustainability stance of the Obama administration. I'll talk about that in several pieces. Key appointments, the guidance the administration has provided to federal agencies, initiatives that these agencies are taking, revitalizing broad interagency efforts in the sustainability domain, and new studies and assessments. Let me start with some of the key appointments. It really is quite impressive. Jane Lubchenco, most of you know, is a former president of this society, of the ESA, very distinguished marine ecologist. Lisa Jackson, an amazing powerhouse at the head of EPA, absolutely determined to advance the sustainability agenda, trained, by the way, in chemical engineering. She knows what she's talking about on the technical side, and she is a rock of strength and determination in this domain. Her assistant administrator for R&D is Paul Anastas, one of the fathers of green chemistry. Again, very strong commitment to sustainability. USGS, headed by Marcia McNutt, the former head of MBARI, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. USAID is headed by an amazing guy named Raj Shah, an MD who has worked extensively in medicine and health in the development domain. Again, totally committed to the sustainability agenda. CEQ Chair Nancy Sutley is terrific. Carol Browner, the longest serving and probably most successful head of the EPA in the past as the head of the Office of Energy and Climate Coordination in the White House. Sherry Abbott, my associate director for environment at OSTP, formerly head of sustainability for the University of Texas Austin, and before that the chief international officer of the AAAS. PCAST has an amazing collection of environmental powerhouses, including Rosina Bierbaum, Mario Molina, Barbara Schall, the vice president of the National Academy of Sciences, a distinguished biologist, and Dan Schrag, the head of the university-wide environment center at Harvard. The president actually meets with these folks. This is the president meeting with his Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, with some of the folks just mentioned visible in the picture. And we have been providing a lot of guidance to agencies on what we expect from agencies in the sustainability domain. The President issued an executive order on federal leadership in environmental, energy, and economic performance in October, and its stated purpose was to establish an integrated strategy towards sustainability in the federal government and to make reduction of greenhouse gases a priority. It requires that every agency designate a senior sustainability officer, that sustainable buildings practices and acquisition policies be put in place, and it calls for setting targets for greenhouse gas reductions in all of the federal agencies. Just last month, the President signed a new executive order on a national oceans policy. Its stated purpose is to ensure that the ocean, our coasts, the Great Lakes are healthy and resilient, safe and productive for present and future generations. And it creates a National Oceans Council, which I chair with the CEQ chairman, Nancy Sutley. This is an excerpt from a memo of just a couple of weeks ago that every year the director of the OMB and the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy send all the federal department heads and agency heads on what the President expects and what we expect to be reflected in the budget submissions of those agencies. And here are some of the things that are called for as priorities in this letter that Peter Orszag and I just sent out on July 21st. Understanding, adapting to, and mitigating the impacts of global climate change. Supporting an integrated national climate assessment of climate change science, impacts, vulnerabilities, and response strategies, including mitigation and adaptation. And explicitly, you will see a certain resonance with some of my remarks. Managing the competing demands on land, freshwater, and the oceans for the production of food, fiber, biofuels, and ecosystem services, and managing them based on sustainability and biodiversity, and supporting research on integrated ecosystem management approaches. This is guidance to every federal department and agency. The agencies are taking a variety of initiatives. Department of Energy and Department of Transportation got together about $80 billion for clean and efficient energy in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The DOE created the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy with $700 million already. EPA and Department of Transportation collaborated to develop and roll out the first ever combined fuel economy and CO2 tailpipe standards. My office, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the Department of Energy, and the State Department have been hard at work strengthening bilateral partnerships on energy and climate change with China, India, Brazil, Russia, and more. NASA, NOAA, and DOD are finally getting their act together, restructuring the National Polar Orbiting Operational Environmental Satellite System, NPOS, so that it can finally succeed. And we are funding a replacement for the orbiting carbon observatory that crashed into the ocean as a result of a launch failure. NOAA is restructuring to consolidate its climate services activity germane to climate change adaptation. Department of Interior is restructuring to develop climate change response centers and landscape conservation cooperatives and a carbon storage project. EPA is on track to reform the Toxic Substances Control Act to stress sound science, risk-based criteria, and green chemistry. Department of Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, and EPA have a partnership for sustainable communities. And the CEQ is leading implementation of an executive order on restoration of Chesapeake Bay and also leading the restoration of the Gulf Initiative, which we are now ramping up as the oil spill, we hope, finally comes to a close of the active leakage phase. Revitalizing broad interagency efforts. We have in this government, I think for the first time, what the President calls his Green Cabinet. The Green Cabinet is a subset of the full cabinet consisting of the Secretaries of Energy, Interior, Agriculture, Transportation, HUD, and Labor, the EPA Administrator, the Small Business Administration Administrator, CEQ Chair, OSTP Director. It's chaired by Carol Browner. It meets regularly, and it meets with the President regularly to talk about strategy for moving towards sustainability, including its energy and climate change component, but not restricted to that. The National Science and Technology Council, which is an interagency entity, which I chair, which has high-level representation from all of the federal departments and agencies that have anything to do with science and technology, has four major committees, one on science, one on technology, one on national security, and one called the CENR, the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And it is, under the chairmanship of Sherry Abbott, Jane Lubchenco, and Paul Anastas, it's being repurposed as the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Sustainability. There is an interagency climate change adaptation task force, which is co-chaired by OSTP, CEQ, and NOAA, and has senior representation from all of the relevant agencies. And, of course, there is the extremely important U.S. Global Change Research Program, has 13 departments involved in it, coordinating their efforts on global change research. Broad legislative mandate, coordination of a comprehensive and integrated United States research program, which will assist the nation and the world to understand, assess, predict, and respond to human-induced and natural processes of global change. Goals, obviously, ever more important. Response, obviously, includes both mitigation and adaptation. The budgets of the U.S. GCRP are on the rise. The 2011 proposal is for $2.6 billion, up almost 20% in real terms from 2010, although it also got a big boost in the Recovery Act, as you see in this diagram. What we aim to do in the U.S. GCRP is, first of all, strengthen the science core, including, as indicated here, regional climate prediction, better understanding of precipitation, of ice, of aerosols, and paleoclimatic studies, but a variety of new emphases as well, adaptation research, integrating complex human dimensions, including economics, management, governance, behavior, equity, interdisciplinary research, and reaching out to the wide community of researchers, engineers, and other experts who work on reducing risk. Integrated assessment, engaging localities and sectors to aggregate information into a national picture, gathering information on the demand side of the adaptation problem, providing information and capabilities that people need to respond to the impacts that they're experiencing. Climate services, analysis and assessment that's ongoing, science-based, user-responsive and relevant, communicating climate change information to users, and coordination among science, adaptation, and mitigation. And by the way, another recent National Academies report, America's Climate Choices, which has four volumes, science, mitigation, adaptation, and synthesis, is well worth your attention if you haven't seen it yet. New studies and assessments, the National Assessment of Climate Change, which sits under the U.S. GCRP and shares its new emphases, led by Kathy Jacobs as its director, who sits in OSTP with me, Tom Carl and Tim Killeen, Tom Carl of NOAA, Tim Killeen of NSF, playing major roles. Continuing interagency and science community focus on climate change adaptation, OSTP, CEQ, NOAA together in the Adaptation Task Force, a National Adaptation Summit, which again the peripatetic Rosina Bierbaum was instrumental in getting done, in May launched a community-wide effort to develop a national adaptation strategy with science goals, data strategy, metrics, and interaction with state and local planners and publics. New studies. There is a new study underway in PCAST at the President's request on biodiversity preservation and ecosystem sustainability. It's BPES is the abbreviation. Again, Rosina's fingerprints are all over this. The statement of task, how can the federal government protect the nation's biodiversity and sustainably manage ecosystems? What do we need to do in the way of research, monitoring, and long-term data sets? Topic areas, economic, the drivers, valuation, human and wildlife, health impacts of change, assessment and monitoring protocols, information and coordination infrastructures, international aspects, and identification of the highest return investments. And finally, I am going to finish in the advertised 45 minutes. The Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, MOB, the conceptual basis of this is that while improving understanding of the natural science and technological bases of sustainability is desirable, and that's a lot of what I've been talking about here, enough is already known to justify and shape remedial action. But societies are not taking the actions that the science indicates are needed and that the technology indicates are possible, and it's important for us to understand why not. Why are we not taking the kinds of actions that it should be obvious we need to take? The reasons clearly are rooted in human behavior and thus the obvious need to bring to bear understandings from social science and the humanities. MOB aims to engage scholars from the social sciences and the humanities with natural scientists and technologists, with policymakers, and with the public to talk about and explore how societal actions can be better matched to what we know and are learning about sustainability. This initiative, the MOB, was first proposed by Paul Ehrlich and Don Kennedy, both well known to this society, in 2005. And the concept, of course, is consistent with recommendations that we've had from the National Academies and many others that the human dimensions of sustainability desperately need more attention. The mob today remains an embryonic effort, largely centered at Stanford, Washington State, Colorado State, and Drexel. But the disconnect that it addresses could hardly be more obvious than from the Senate's failure to act on energy and climate change. Just in the last few weeks, they've dropped the ball. Failure to act on energy and climate change in the midst of record heat, drought, floods, and wildfires all across the planet. It is across the planet. It really is mind-boggling that in this particular summer, the lack of will to take action has become so conspicuous. And so one can only wish the mob every success as it grapples with this. Paul, carry on. I know there was a session today about the mob, and I'm sure many insights emerge from that that will help drive it forward. The best news for sustainability, I believe, is that we have a president who's paying attention. This is the president, again, at a PCAST meeting, preparing to read something that PCAST provided him. And he actually does read the stuff we provide him. It's astonishing. You know, most White Houses have a rule that you cannot give the president more than 2 pages about anything. No memo can be more than 2 pages. I've given this president 10 pages repeatedly, and he comes back the next morning after taking it upstairs in his 2-inch-thick evening reading book, and he knows everything in the 10 pages and asks the key question that turns me and my co-authors into deer in the headlights. And he has vision. I kind of like this picture. This was from an event called Astronomy for Kids on the White House lawn. The president's looking through a telescope at a supernova in front of 150 middle school math and science students. But I like the metaphor of a president with vision, and so I'll stop with that. Thank you very much. Okay, go ahead. Whoever got there first, proceed. A technological failure already. Okay, you better shout. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. The question, I'll be happy to talk about that. The question is, why didn't I say anything about education? And the answer is purely time constraint. I give a longer talk about the science and technology priorities of the administration, in which I pretty much start with education. The president has been clear that he thinks the single most important thing we can do for the future of our country is lift the level of science, technology, and math education in this country. And we've been doing a lot to bring that about. We put a big chunk of money for education into the stimulus package. The president launched an initiative called Educate to Innovate last November with $500 million of private and philanthropic support to improve science and math teaching in middle schools and high schools. And sustainability, obviously, is an important part of that. We've got science teachers and math teachers from middle schools and high schools from around the country coming in all the time. I met on Monday with a group of 100 of the most successful math and science high school teachers from around the country. We are constantly trying to get ideas from them and infuse those ideas into the administration's initiatives in the education domain. I shouldn't have left it out here, but I was compressing too diligently. A good question, and I would say the attention being paid to the P&I PAT at the moment is largely through measures connected with our international cooperation and development initiatives of a variety of kinds to improve the condition of women around the world, women's health, women's education, women's opportunity, women's rights, because that is both the highest leverage way to reduce birth rates and also one that just about everybody accepts as something that, that is well worth doing, whether you're interested in reducing birth rates or not. I think ultimately there will be expanded attention to the population component of things from government and elsewhere. Paul Ehrlich will eventually prevail. But I would say the main thrust at the moment is in that domain and in making sure that people have access to family planning services and so on. There is no effort at the moment to develop a national population policy, although I would say it is a natural component, ultimately, of sustainability policy, and so I suspect that there will be folks thinking about it. Hello there, Peter. Well, first of all, the president has made clear, and he did it in his State of the Union speech, and he's done it in speeches at MIT and in various other places. He has made clear his continuing determination to deal with the energy and climate change challenge. And he made clear quite recently his desire to have a price on greenhouse gas emissions stay in the energy bill, which the Senate then proceeded not to do. I think that this issue is not going away. I think if you note that last week the EPA batted down 10 petitions for them to revisit their endangerment finding, I think you can take that as an indication that EPA intends to move forward with regulating greenhouse gases as an interim strategy until the Congress comes to its senses and passes a bill that puts a price on greenhouse gas emissions. There is no question in my mind or in any of the minds of the people around the president that he remains committed to this. How many issues the president can absolutely go to the mat on in any one moment is always a tough question in politics, and I have to assume that there was a fairly careful counting of votes and it was determined no matter how hard the president might use the bully pulpit. We weren't going to get the votes this time, and that perhaps a more powerful approach will be to have the EPA start regulating greenhouse gas emissions, and then we'll see what the Congress thinks about that. What the science community and the NGO community can do is continue to work on educating the public. I think the public is actually further along than they generally get credit for. You know, all this business about how climate change got less popular in the polls after ClimateGate. The most recent polls have shown, number one, there's been some rebound, and number two, a good deal of the original loss was people on the right end of the political spectrum who didn't really care much about climate change in the first place and weren't very committed to it. The polls I've seen lately still show that something in the range of 70% or more of the American public believe climate change is an important problem and are willing to do something about it, even if it costs something. to do something about it. So I actually think the public is ahead of the politicians, as is sometimes the case in this country, and we need to mobilize their voices better, but we also need to reinforce the view of the public that climate change is a problem that we cannot continue to ignore.
It's clear that we're not going to get much action from Congress. I'm very impressed with what the executive branch is doing, and we have a history of executive orders over the decades being very effective in guiding what happens on a national level. My question is, how confident do you feel in that executive process, which you outlined as being very impressive in terms of sustainability, in addressing these important issues independent of the legislative process? And secondly, how can we get the word out better to the mass media about the kinds of initiatives that you so clearly and positively outlined?
Well, that's an interesting two-part question. I think there's a lot we can do in the executive branch without Congress. And when we fail to get what we need from Congress, we will always look to those options that we have in the executive branch, including executive orders and presidential memoranda and the like that lay out strategies for achieving our goals. It would be nice to have the help of the Congress because some of these things are hard to achieve without it. And we're going to continue to work on that as well. As far as doing a better job of getting into the media, we're trying. It's a challenge. The media, as you know, are increasingly soundbite oriented. The amount of serious journalism in our newspapers has been shrinking as the newspapers, the print media, are under great stress from competition from the internet and from soundbite television. We keep struggling with it. How do you get the messages out there? There are, there are still some good folks writing about this stuff. I think of Andy Revkin, who still writes for the New York Times some of the time and blogs all of the time on these issues. Joe Rome, who has a fabulous blog on this stuff. Nick Sunt at the World Wildlife Fund. There are a lot of good folks putting a lot of good stuff out there, but much of it is not making it into the mainstream media. And I spend a fair amount of time trying to talk to folks in the mainstream media, but I can't lead the charge on this business from my post in the White House where it looks like, improper intervention. And so I'm just hopeful that our NGOs, like the UCS, we just heard from Peter Frumhoff, like the NRDC, like the Environmental Defense Fund, like the Sierra Club, and so on, all keep doing their job getting the word out there. And there are some very good other organizations, the Center for American Progress, progressive organizations that aren't focused only on environment but which continue to push out sensible messages on these issues. But we sure need all the help we can get.
All right. I wanted to thank you for your talk and commend the administration for the efforts that they've already taken on a variety of science and technology issues, especially in restoring scientific integrity to the federal government. And I know a lot of action's been taken at the department and agency level, but as you yourself have noted, a presidential-level scientific integrity directive is at this point over a year late. And I was wondering if you could comment on where that process is today and what we can do as scientists to help make sure that these changes sort of outlast the Obama administration.
Well, first of all, I would point out that the President's Memorandum of March 9, 2009 on scientific integrity, which laid out six principles that the agencies and departments are expected to follow, has been in force since then. That is, those principles have been in force across the agencies. And we have taken a number of actions in the domain of scientific integrity and open government since then. We have not, as your question suggests, issued the supplementary guidance to those six principles which the President's memorandum directed me to develop. And the reason for that is a very long process of public comment and input, interaction with the agencies, interaction with NGOs, internal discussion of what the best approaches are in terms of how we elaborate on these principles in a way that really provides additional guidance but is still general enough to apply across the agencies. Where that process is now, I believe that we are within a month of issuing that supplementary guidance, and that will indeed create a new wave of interest and attention to this important set of issues.
As we've seen in one of the other lectures, one of the seemingly most effective ways to decrease CO2 is to have a global economic meltdown. And so I'm wondering what, if any, thought the federal government has given to the interaction between economic development and global climate change and the risks. I mean, people are suggesting somewhat maybe extremist ideas like a steady-state economy, which is a good idea, but in practice, whatever. So I'm just wondering if you could have any comments on that.
First of all, nobody in the administration is investigating or recommending that we solve the climate change problem through economic catastrophe. I tried to indicate at the beginning that I think all three pillars of well-being are indispensable, and we need to find ways to nourish each pillar in ways that do not whittle down the others. The question of how you achieve a measure of material prosperity for the billions of people in the world who don't yet have it without contributing additionally to the drivers of climate change is a big challenge, but several things are important to remember there. One is that we do have a range of technological options that make it possible to supply energy more cleanly, more efficiently, and with much lower greenhouse gas emissions than the current world energy system does. And we can certainly buy some headroom by applying those options not just in developing countries, but in the industrialized countries that until recently accounted for the bulk of the global emissions. The World Bank Development Report for 2010 is entirely focused on the question of development and climate change and how we can get this done, how we can improve the levels of living around the world where they're most in need of improvement without wrecking the climate, and I think that's the way to look at it. That's also the way the UN report that I described earlier, with the subtitle Avoiding the Unmanageable and Managing the Unavoidable, looked at it. We're just not going to get anywhere with this problem by saying, gee, isn't recession great? Let's have a depression and really solve it. That's not going to happen. Thank you.